Join us now for the Chapel Hour, coming to you from the campus of Bob Jones University. Today's message was preached during a Sunday morning worship service held on the university campus. Our speaker is Dr. Royce Short, Dean of the School of Religion at BJU. The title of his message is, Putting Feet to the Truth, What Does It Mean to Be Holy? The text is from Leviticus chapters 18 through 20.
Turn in your Bibles, please, to the book of Exodus, chapter 19. This will not be our final text, but we will start there in just a moment. Exodus chapter 19. Just by way of a reminder, so you know where we're coming from, and if there happens to be any visitors here, so they know why I've chosen this particular theme, Dr. Stephen Jones, our president, has chosen as the theme for this school year, Putting Feet to the Truth. And the major thrust that he is giving this school year as he develops the theme is simply that if we're really saved, we have to be living out the Word of God on a daily basis. In other words, we can't compartmentalize our lives and say, I will put my head on, my spiritual head on Sunday, and I'll go to church and do everything that good Christians do on Sunday. But then Monday to Saturday is my own or are my own days and I will do my own thing. That is an impossibility. That can't be done. And that's why this is a fantastic theme for the year of putting feet to the truth. Because if God has really implanted new life in an individual, that new life can't help but be seen every day in every way as we walk with Him. And so I would like to simply, on the Sunday morning, continue to explore that theme that we've been talking about in chapel all week. And we're going to be talking about a good bit more in chapel this coming month as well as throughout the year. But I thought while our thoughts are on that theme, we might as well go ahead and have another message along that line. Now, I'm going to be doing something perhaps a little different in that I'm going to use the Old Testament as our text this morning so that we can see that this is the very theme that God was telling His people in Old Testament days as well. He was telling them, if you really are a called out person, if you really are, the term we would use today, saved, if you're really part of the covenant, then he says, you have to live a godly life. You have to live a life that puts feet to the truth. Eventually, we will get to Leviticus chapter 18 to 20, which is going to be our ultimate text for this morning. But before we get there, we have to backtrack just a little bit so that that text even makes a greater sense. In other words, we have to maybe put a few stage props on the stage so that we really get the thrust of what God is telling us. In Exodus chapters 1 to 14, we have this wonderful story of God's redemption of His people from the land of Egypt. For 430 years, they had been slaves there, and now just the right time in history and the right time in God's plan came along. And so, as you know, God came down and He delivered them. Now, 6.5 centuries prior to this, He had met with Abraham and called Abraham out of Ur of the Chaldees and entered into a special relationship with him. And He said, you are going to be the father of this nation. And now about 650 years later, God is molding these people together as a nation. In these intervening years, He's been multiplying them. And now as He brought them out of Egypt, He indeed showed His great power and glory. As you know, as the Bible tells us, He rolled up His sleeves. And He went to work, and through the 10 plagues and through the deliverance at the Red Sea, He delivered His people from Egypt. Well, then, when we come to Exodus 16 through 19, we see that God now has His people in the Sinai Peninsula, and He is very explicitly leading them to a certain place. He's leading them to the southern tip, basically, of the Sinai Peninsula, where we have Mount Sinai. And from Exodus 16 through 19, we see how God was taking them there. And when they got to Mount Sinai, God entered into a special covenant with them. And for approximately just a couple of weeks short of a year, in other words, almost 12 months, God had His people camped out at Mount Sinai there in the southern Sinai Peninsula in order that He might give them some very, very needed instruction and direction so that they would know exactly what it means to be this specially called out people of God. In fact, I like the way one writer has referred to this time. He says this Mount Sinai experience is the Mount Everest of Pentateuchal theology. And boy, is that ever true, because when Israel was at Mount Sinai, they not only were on the mount or at the base of the mountain, God was appearing to them on the mount, but this was also a high water mark theologically for them as God was going to mold them into a nation. And so in Exodus chapter 19, verses 4 following, the children of Israel are here at Mount Sinai. And notice what God said, ye have seen what I did unto the Egyptians and how I bare you on eagle's wings and brought you unto myself. He's looking back and referring to the marvelous plagues and the deliverance at the Red Sea. Now, therefore, if ye will obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant, then ye shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel. Notice that expression, I brought you unto myself. God says, I called you out and brought you to myself. And then he used three very key expressions to describe this relationship. First of all, he says, you are a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, or out of the number of all peoples. So this has reference to the fact that these people are God's special, shall we say, valued property. God has purchased them for himself. This is his treasure. And notice also what he says when he says, all the earth is mine. The point he seems to be making is, I could have chosen anybody in all the world to be in this special relationship to me if I'd have wanted to. But instead, I sovereignly selected you people. You are special to me. And then he said, you are a kingdom of priests. That is, you are going to have access to me as no other people in the entire world have access to me. I will enable you. I will make it possible for you to be able to come to me and have a sweet fellowship. And then he says, you are also a holy nation. And we'll talk more about what that means as the message progresses. And so for approximately the next 12 months, as I said, this Mount Everest of theology, at this Mount Everest of theology, God is going to show the people exactly what it means to be this kind of special people. They were not just ordinary people. They weren't just another nomadic tribe running around the ancient Near East. They were a special people called of God into a special relationship for a special reason. And God said, I'm going to sit you down here at the mount, and you're going to have to listen to a lot of sermons, a lot of illustrations. You're going to get a lot of visual aids so that you understand what it really means if you're going to be the people of God. Now, sorry to say, this block of material that God gave them at Mount Sinai, which goes from Exodus 20 through Numbers chapter 10, this happens to be, at least is considered by many Christians, some of the most boring material in all the Bible. So I'll kind of give you a warning, since our message today is going to come from Leviticus, the very heart of this boring section. This would be a good time for you maybe to get out your pillows, or if you brought an inflatable donut to sit on so your seat would be a little softer, this would be a good time to get it out. So these next 34 minutes or so, you'll at least be in comfort while you're being bored. I say that with tongue in cheek, of course, because these are some of the richest passages in the Bible, even though most people very seldom will read them. Now, in this huge section, let me summarize it, okay? As we summarize this huge section of material that God is giving them at Sinai, what do we find? Well, we find God is making provision for them to be in a right relationship with himself because he instituted the sacrificial system. So as you're reading about all these sacrifices and so on, and you're beginning to say, but so what? Why did God have to give all those details? Big deal. Let's get on with it. Stop and say, wait a minute. God has told these people that they are a kingdom of priests. They will have access to him. They can call upon him. They can know that he will answer and he'll respond. So God says, let me tell you what you need to do in order that you might have access to me and in order that the way will always be clear. During this time, God set apart a very special class of people to be the mediatorial representatives for the people, and that was none other than the priesthood. So we have a good bit of material on the priesthood. During this time, God made arrangements so that he could dwell in the very midst of his special covenant people, so he could be right there, as we would say, on the desert floor, living in a tent with them. That's the tabernacle material. So you have about 15 chapters dedicated just to tabernacle material, which you begin to read and say, boring, get on with this. No, that's at the very heart of the covenant, because God says, I want to dwell in your midst. I am not just a God out there who could care less. I am a God down here with you. And I want you to know what it means to have a place right in your midst where I'm dwelling with you. And then God also gave them a good bit of material, the revelation of his character in the law. In other words, the legal material. As you're reading from this block, Exodus 20 to Numbers 10, there are an awful lot of laws that are given to us. But remember, the law is a reflection of the very character of God. That's what God is like. That's the very stuffing out of which he is made. So when he made a law, when he gave a law, he says, this is what I am like. And that's why I'm asking you to do these things, because if you're going to reflect me, the person with whom you've entered into a covenant with, you've got to know what my heartbeat is. You've got to know what my very character is. And a little bit later, we'll come back more to the legal material. Okay, so that's what God is setting them up for these 11 and a half, almost 12 months. He's saying you need this all important material so you know what it means to walk with God. Now let's jump over to Leviticus chapter 11 and get one step closer to our ultimate text. Leviticus chapter 11, and we stop here simply because in these couple verses we get a great summary preview of the things that are going to be constantly drilled into us when we get to our ultimate text. Leviticus 11 actually comes in the midst of one of these very boring sections, or so it would seem. Clean and unclean animals, purification of women after childbirth. What do you do after somebody's had leprosy to cleanse them, and so on. And at the very heart of this, notice what God says in Leviticus 11:44-45. For I am the Lord your God. Ye shall therefore sanctify yourselves, and ye shall be holy, for I am holy. Neither shall ye defile yourselves with any manner of creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. For I am the Lord that bringeth you up out of the land of Egypt to be your God. Ye shall therefore be holy, for I am holy. So the Lord is telling them by these three phrases, in effect, here is the ground, or here is the basis for all this instruction I'm going to give you. First of all, notice that expression, I am the Lord your God, at the beginning of verse 44. In other words, with this expression, God is telling them, I have divine authority to tell you what to do. When I speak, it has a heavenly origin to it. And therefore, you could summarize that with God's lordship. God has a right to be Lord of the lives of these people. Secondly, notice in the end of verse 44 and the end of verse 45, sanctify yourselves and be holy because I am holy. God says, my character is holy. And therefore, if you're going to be a child of mine, you too need to duplicate that in your lives. And number three, notice the expression in the beginning of verse 45, I am the Lord who bringeth you up out of the land of Egypt to be your God. God is reminding them that he redeemed them. And therefore, on the basis of his redemptive activity, they are his special people. God never redeemed. God never brought any other nation out from the kind of circumstances that the children of Israel had been involved in. God never saved another people like he saved the Israelites. And therefore, God says, you are in a special relationship to me, and you must never forget my redemptive activity on your behalf. So we could summarize those three great points with, when God speaks words to them, it is based on his lordship, it is based on his character, and it is based on his relationship to them. Now, that brings us, if you'll turn over a few pages, to Leviticus 18-20. Leviticus 18-20, where our key text will occur. These three chapters are a portion of the greater part of Leviticus, Leviticus 17-26, which is often referred to as the Holiness Code, simply because the word holy or holiness occurs so many times jam-packed within approximately these 10 chapters. However, we could view holiness as the theme for the entire book of Leviticus, because this root word for holiness, the verb, the noun, the adjective, occurs almost 150 times in the book of Leviticus. And when something occurs that often in one book, I get the sneaky feeling God is trying to tell me that's a key thread, or that's a punchline that I ought to take note of in the book. So we might ask ourselves a simple question. What does this basic root, this basic thought of holiness mean? What is God talking about when he keeps telling these people, I am a holy God, therefore you are to be a holy people. I am a holy God, therefore I am sanctifying you. In other words, we could bring that into English, I am going to make you holy. What is that all about? What does that mean? Well, it starts off basically with just the idea of separateness. Okay, for something to be holy, it meant it was separate. It was set apart from other things. And so specifically here, in this case, it comes down to two major things. As God uses this concerning himself, he's talking about his transcendence. So as you read certain parts of the Old Testament and the children of Israel praise God and say, our God is holy. In many of those contexts, you will find they are exalting God. They are saying, our God is above every other God. There is no other God like our God. He is unique. He is a one-of-a-kind God. And that's exactly right. God is totally separate from his creation. He is totally separate from us. He is totally separate from everything else. There is no God like our God. But more practically, shall we say, God is also totally separate from sin. And so this word holiness has to do with separation from sin, being separated or distinct from sin. In other words, being absolutely pure. So, for example, like in the text I just read in Leviticus 11, when God said, I am holy and you should be holy, God was telling them, I am totally set apart from sin. I have an allergic reaction if I'd ever come into contact with sin. I am absolutely pure. And that characteristic of God is a characteristic he can require of us as his people. He can require that we too be pure people, because now that we are his children, he says, I am seeking to duplicate that particular divine attribute or that particular characteristic in those that I call my own. And so when we come now to Leviticus 18 to 20, we have a great summary section, if you will, where God is going to tell them that this is what it means to be a holy people of God. Remember, they're there at the mountain. They're receiving all this instruction concerning the tabernacle, concerning sacrifices, concerning God dwelling in their midst, concerning the priesthood. And then they're getting all these other rules, which would have been very easy for them to say, but wait a minute. Who does God think he is to basically cramp my style and tell me this is the way you need to live? And God says, wait a minute. He says, I've called you unto myself. You are a very special people. I selected you out of the number of all the other nations. And he says, if you really are a people in a special relationship with me, I am Lord, I am holy, and I redeemed you. Therefore, I have the right to tell you how you need to live on a daily basis. And so as we go through Leviticus 18 to 20, God is going to answer for them the question, what does it mean to be holy? Does it mean that we simply put on our Sabbath go-to-meeting clothes and put a big grin on our face and impress everybody that we're a goody-goody for one day of the week? Or another Israelite might have said, well, does holiness mean that I always have to talk about spiritual or religious subjects? Another Israelite might have chimed in and said, well, does holiness mean that I need to be holy only in public venues, but what I do in private is my own business? And in effect, God is going to answer all of these questions. And he's going to say, I'm going to tell you what it means to be this holy people of God who is specially set apart to their Redeemer. Now, we're only going to have time to kind of do a touchdown, kind of like an airplane pilot who flies over this big perspective and then occasionally touches down and takes off and flies over some more and touches down, because naturally we don't have the time to go into all this verse by verse. But what I'm going to try and do is give you four major things that God really emphasizes here. And the reason I believe I can say these are four major emphases is because they just recur so many times in these four chapters. But I'll only be able to touch on even some of the illustrations of even these four. So let's start off number one. If you're taking notes or to try and keep this in your head, number one, God says holiness forbids practicing pagan practices. Holiness forbids practicing pagan practices. Where do we get that? Well, chapter 18 begins on that very note. Let's read 18:1-5. We're in the book of Leviticus, chapter 18. The Lord spake unto Moses, saying, speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, I am the Lord your God. Here we go. After the doings of the land of Egypt wherein ye dwelt, shall ye not do. And after the doings of the land of Canaan, whither I bring you, shall ye not do. Neither shall ye walk in their ordinances. Ye shall do my judgments and keep mine ordinances to walk therein. I am the Lord your God. Ye shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, which if a man do, he shall live in them. I am the Lord. Okay, so right at the very start now, here they are at Sinai. And notice what God did as he's reminding them, if you are my special people, that forbids you engaging in pagan practices. So he looked back to their past 430 years in Egypt and he said, the dear people, you cannot do what Egyptian people do. He looked forward to the land of Canaan because he knew that's where he was leading them to be the promised land. And he said, dear people, when you get to Canaan, you cannot do what a typical Canaanite does. Because they are pagans. They have their own gods, their own goddesses, their own worship ritual, their own daily things that they do because of the gods and goddesses they worship. And as we know from archaeology, Egyptian religion and especially Canaanite religion, very, very, very perverse. I think Canaanite religion can be summarized in two words. It was violent and it was sexual. Everything about Canaanite gods and goddesses had to do with murder and rape and violence, you name it. And God said, I'm telling you right now, that's why I camped you out at Sinai for 12 months. You've got to get this in your head. You've got to be washed from what you just saw in Egypt so that those things are no longer part of you. But you also need to prepare yourself so when you get to Canaan and see all these nice neighbors doing all these things and saying, well, you're in Canaan, why don't you just go ahead and do what we do? This is a local custom. He says, can't do that. You've got to remember, you are a special people of God, and holiness forbids engaging in pagan practices. As you continue to the end of chapter 18, he concludes the chapter in the same way, picking up at 18:24. Defile not ye yourselves in any of these things, for in all these the nations are defiled, which I cast out before you. Verse 27, all these abominations have the men of the land done, which were before you, and the land is defiled. Verse 28, that the land spew not you out also when you defile it, as it spewed out the nations who were before you. Verse 30, therefore shall ye keep mine ordinances, that ye commit not any one of these abominable customs which were committed before you, and that ye defile not yourselves therein. I am the Lord. You see what the Lord is saying? He says, when you go to Canaan, I'm going to drive out the people who are there, those Canaanites, to give you the land. And God says, the reason I'm driving them out is because of their utter perversity, their total paganism. And God said they defiled the land. And did you notice four times he uses the word abominable concerning their activity? God says what they did was abominable. It was disgusting. And God says, that's why when you get there, you don't go up to a Canaanite and say, how do you live? I want to do just what you do. God says, no, holiness demands that you do not engage in pagan practices. We get to chapter 19, and in the very heart of this, all throughout chapter 19, you find some of these, but at the very heart of chapter 19, verses 26 following, we find an example, like in verse 26, the last part of it. Neither shall you use enchantments nor observe times. You see, dear people, people are always interested in knowing the future. People always want to know, well, what's down the road? What's around the next corner? And so what do? They get involved in necromancy. They get involved in witchcraft. They get involved in all kinds of sorcery. But God says that's what the pagans do to try and figure out the future. But you are the special people of God. And therefore, he says, I will tell you about the future what you need to know. And if I don't tell you something about the future, just figure that it's not important for you to know that future event. It is important for you to simply trust me today. And so as you keep reading, not just in this section, but throughout the Pentateuch, over and over, the Lord will tell them, you can't go to witches, you can't go to sorcerers, you can't read your Ouija board, you can't do all these things. And you say, well, why did God have to keep saying it? He had to keep saying it because their environment was one where people constantly engaged in that stuff to try and know the future. And God said, if you want to know the future, you seek my face and I will tell you. And if I'm not pleased to tell you, it means you don't need to know. There are more important things for you. And then we get to chapter 20. And what do we have? I'll skip over this, but when you start out in chapter 20, you have the Lord telling them, now when you get into the land, I don't want you to sacrifice your children to this Ammonite deity by the name of Molech. And you say, wow, that's a terrible thing to do. I mean, to sacrifice your offspring, but not only that, it would be idolatry. You say, why would God need to warn them about that? Would people really do that? Yes, they really did it. That was a pagan practice that people engaged in. And you know what? As you keep reading the Old Testament, you find later people in the history of God's people, supposed God's people, actually worshiping their children to the god Molech, because they thought somehow that would ingratiate his favor. That would get him on their side. So God knows what he's talking about when right here during this 12 months, he says, I'm trying to drill into you. I'm trying to pound into you over and over again some key things. And he says, dear people, he says, holiness forbids pagan practices. If you really are a member of the covenant people of God, you can't walk, you can't live like pagans live. Number two, holiness requires one to submit to his lordship. Holiness requires one to submit to his lordship. Did you notice even in the few places I've already read how many times the Lord says, I am the Lord, or I am the Lord your God? Almost 50 times in chapter 18, 19, and 20 that phrase recurs. Now you say, well, why did God keep repeating it? Did he think they were deaf? Or was God a little senile and he forgot that he'd even said that before? No, it's intentional, because he's trying to drive home to them, I am the Lord. I am the Lord your God. And what is the emphasis of that expression? Remember what we said just a moment ago. It reminded them, number one, that what was being said was of divine origin. This wasn't just another human being on the horizontal plane saying, hey, bud, I think it'd be good if you did this. This was a vertical message from heaven. This was God speaking. And because it came from heaven, there was this divine authority behind it. God had the right to be Lord and tell them what to do. Think of it like this, young people. Because I think this is a good parallel. It's kind of like a parent-child relationship. And I know none of you did this when you were growing up, even though you have little brothers and sisters who did. But maybe your mom or dad would say something like, son or daughter, I want you to do something. And generally, what's the first response of a child? Go ahead. Why? Thank you. At least a couple of you have done that in your life. That's right. That's a typical response. But why? Okay, now let's see if you were listening. What is the typical parental response to your why? Ah, yeah, you heard that a lot. Because I said so. In other words, in effect, your mom or your dad was basically saying, on the one hand, they might have been saying, you know, little Joey, you are not capable of understanding an answer if I even gave you one. Or they might have simply said, you need to simply learn to obey when I say something, and I don't need to give you a lot of reasons behind it and so on. But they are simply saying, I am the adult in this family. I'm the parent. I have a right to tell you, and you are a child. You have an obligation to obey. And that is exactly what God was telling these people. There are times when you read these laws, God will give a rationale and say, here's the reason why I want you to do this or not do this. But there are many other times where God will simply give a law. Here's the law. And then God will simply, the very next phrase is, I am the Lord, or I am the Lord your God. Another law. I am the Lord your God. Another law. I am the Lord your God. It's not because he's being mean. I suppose we could in one sense say most of us don't have the cerebral ability to grasp the rationale behind a lot of these things anyhow, even if he tried to explain them to us. So we just simply need to know, you know, I've got a Father in heaven who cares more for me than I care for myself. He has brought me into a special relationship with himself, and he's leading me so that I can actually be like he is, so that I can have the very moral likeness of my Father. I believe he has a right to be my Lord. I believe I really can trust him with what he says. And that's exactly what God was trying to teach these people at Sinai. Whenever God speaks, that is sufficient. You don't need to complain about it. You don't need rationale behind it before you obey. You simply need to know it's a message from heaven, and therefore you need to obey it. Holiness forbids pagan practices. Holiness requires one to submit to his lordship. Number three, holiness requires his child to be holy because God is holy. Holiness requires his children to be holy because God is holy. You know, it's interesting, dear people, that the gods of surrounding nations or cultures could never ground a moral duty or a moral responsibility on their own character. As you read in ancient Near Eastern stuff, you don't just find a god or goddess saying, now be like this because this is what I'm like. Because these gods and goddesses of the ancient Near East were all perverse. They were perverted. They were sinners themselves. But the God of Israel says, remember, I am holy. I'm in a category all by myself. And therefore, I can, because I'm holy, I can require holiness of you. I can ground your holiness in my holiness. My holiness can be the basis for your holiness, because that's the very nature of what I am like. And so as God was ministering to these people at Sinai, he is simply reminding them what it means to be holy. And so, look, if you will, at chapter 20 and verse 24. Chapter 20 and verse 24. We said that holiness means to be set apart from evil, to be set apart from God. So what does God say? 20:24. I have said unto you, you shall inherit their land, and I will give it unto you to possess it, a land that floweth with milk and honey. Now notice this last expression. I am the Lord your God, which have separated you from other people. Now, the word separated here is not the same Hebrew word that's usually translated holy, but it is simply a word that means to be separate, to be set apart. And so God is simply driving this home, even with a word other than the word holy. He says, I am the Lord your God, and I have separated you from other people. Notice in chapter 20 in verse 26, "And ye shall be holy unto me, for I the Lord am holy." There's our word separate. "And I have severed you," that's the same word that was translated separated back in just a couple verses early, "and I have severed you from other people that ye should be mine." So notice how God is grounding what he expects of them in his very nature. He says, "I, the God who redeemed you, am holy. That's my very character. That's my very stuffing. That's what I'm made out of. And now, if you really are my child, I am trying to recreate in you a duplicate of myself. I am trying to make you a holy person like myself." And then when we get over to chapter 20, verses 7 to 8, we have a really neat reference here where we see the divine and human concerning holiness back to back. Verse 7, Leviticus 20, verse 7, "Sanctify yourselves, therefore, and be ye holy, for I am the Lord your God." So God is telling them, you have a part to play in your sanctification. But notice chapter 20, verse 8, "And ye shall keep my statutes and do them. I am the Lord which sanctify you." So in other words, God said there is a divine aspect to sanctification. So God says, you do what you need to do in obeying my laws, and I'll do what I need to do, and you will be a holy people. You will be a people who's absolutely pure. Wow. That's what it meant to be a member of God's special family. But number four, the fourth and the last one, holiness requires obedience to all God's instructions. Okay? Not only does holiness forbid that we engage in pagan practices, not only does holiness require us to submit to his lordship, not only does holiness require us to be holy, holiness requires obedience to everything that God says. And so back in chapter 18 and verse 4, did you notice the Lord says, "You shall do my judgments and keep mine ordinances to walk therein." In chapter 18 and verse 30, we find the almost identical wording, a little different. "Therefore ye shall keep mine ordinances." In chapter 19 and verse 19, "Ye shall keep my statutes." 19:37, "Therefore shall ye observe all my statutes." Chapter 20, verse 22, "Ye shall therefore keep all my statutes and all my judgments and do them." So do you see how all through this section, not only is the Lord giving them instruction, but he's also specifically reminding them, you have an obligation to obey them. You have an obligation to practice them. You have an obligation to do them. Now, as we read these three chapters then, chapters 18, 19, and 20, it's very interesting because we find that God is talking about every possible or every almost conceivable thing that happens to us or can happen to us on a daily or on a weekly basis. In other words, God is trying to show them that holiness, these instructions God gave, actually deal with every part of a person's life on a daily basis. Remember, as we started out and we said, if I'm a special person of God, do I just live like it on Sunday, but Monday to Saturday are mine? God is answering their question very explicitly, and he's saying, if you really are in a special relationship with me, you will be a Sabbath or a Saturday for them, a Saturday through Friday Christian. You will be, as we would say today, a Sunday through Saturday believer. Everything about a person every single day is affected. So very quickly, let me just walk through a couple of things so you see what we're talking about. In chapter 18, verses 6 to 18, holiness requires I have a proper sex life. And to me, I'll be honest with you, when you read chapters 18 and chapter 20, you almost want to go and take a shower after them because it talks about such perverted sexual relationships. And you say, why would God even have to put that in the Bible? Why would God even have to say that? Remember what we said at the very beginning of chapter 18? Israel had just come out of Egypt. Israel is going into Canaan. Very ungodly environments. Environments where ungodly, perverse, all kinds of sexual things prevailed. And so specifically in chapter 18, he hones in on things like incest and bestiality and homosexuality. And you say, why did he have to keep going on and on? Why didn't he just use those three words and say, don't engage in that? He needed to do it because he knew how these people are so bombarded or would be so bombarded with sexual things when they get in the land of Canaan because of the Canaanite deities, the Canaanite gods and goddesses. And so God gets real specific. But his whole point is holiness demands a proper sex life. It demands a sex life in accordance with what God reveals. You go to chapter 19, the beginning of verse 3, and you find that the Lord says, "Ye shall fear every man his mother and his father." Holiness dictates my attitude toward my parents. I can't have a flippant attitude as a child to my parents and say, "I'm a big boy now, I'm a big girl, I can do what I want to do." God says no. Holiness dictates the kind of attitude I show toward my parents. Chapter 19, verses 5 to 8, he gives some instruction concerning the worship ritual. And so he's telling them, holiness demands proper worship ritual. You don't just come to me and say, "Hey God, I'm here, I'm going to do my own thing, and you better accept it because I call it worship, so surely it's worship for you." God says, no way in the world. You would not be accepted. There is a certain way. There are certain things you do when you come to worship God. There's a certain liturgy you follow. And God said, you be sure you do it, because if you don't do it, you're putting yourself in a place of divine judgment. Chapter 19, verses 13 to 14. Holiness requires that I be respectful to others, especially the disadvantaged. He says, don't defraud your neighbor. Don't curse the deaf. Don't put a stumbling block before the blind people. In other words, he says, if you really know God, you've got this vertical relationship, it's going to affect the way you treat other people, especially what we might call people from the other side of the track, or disadvantaged people, or people who are a little lower on the socioeconomic ladder than I am. God says the way you treat them is an indication of whether or not you have a right relationship with God. Holiness affects my attitude toward other people, especially the down and outers. Chapter 19 and verse 15. Holiness requires justice to everyone, whether they be rich or poor. Don't respect the person of the poor. Don't honor the person of the mighty. But in righteousness shalt thou judge thy neighbor. In other words, it's real easy to see somebody who's maybe down and out and simply throw the whole law code at him and say, the guy's probably guilty of that because he's the town drunk, so surely he probably did that. And then here's somebody else who's rich and can pay his way out of something. And you say, I want to stay on that guy's good side, so I'm going to treat him with a completely different standard. God says, that's not my nature. That's not what you can do if you're going to claim to be a child of God. You've got to give justice to everybody, whether the person is poor, whether the person is rich. You can't have two standards by which you treat people. Chapter 19, verse 35. Holiness requires honesty in all my business dealings. Ye shall do no unrighteousness in judgment, and mete it in weight or in measure. Just balances, just weights, a just ephah and a just hin shall ye have. I am the Lord your God, which brought you out of the land of Egypt. In other words, God said, a pound is a pound. A yard is a yard. An ounce is an ounce. You don't sell somebody some cheese if they come to your store and they say, give me a pound of cheese, and you give them 14 ounces and hope they don't go home and weigh it and say, at this rate, I can really make extra money if I cut it short. No. They ordered a pound of cheese, you give them a pound of cheese. Holiness requires honesty in all my business dealings. But dear people, are you beginning to get the point? Are you beginning to see how God is showing these Israelites that if they're going to be his child, that puts a claim on every part of their life, every day of the week, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. There is no part of our life, no matter how private we think it is, that is untouched by the lordship of God. And that's why, as he was dealing with these people at Mount Sinai, he says, this is the basis so that when you get into the land of promise, when you get into Canaan, you'll be able to really enjoy it and you'll know the blessing of God because you'll be on the same page with me and you'll understand what it really means to be a special people. Now, maybe you're thinking, well, did the Israelites obey these laws so that they could be saved? Absolutely not. These laws had nothing to do with their salvation, but rather these laws had everything to do with what we might call their sanctification. Because remember, when did God give them these laws? He gave them these laws after he had delivered them from Egypt, which was basically their salvation experience. So these laws are not dealing with justification. How can I be rightly related to God? These laws are dealing with sanctification. Now that I'm rightly related to God, how can I please him and live a life that is in accord with him? Now, as we begin to conclude and bring this home to ourselves, let me ask the question, what does this really have to do with me? I mean, I'm a 21st century believer, and these laws were written back in the 15th century BC, 3,500 years ago. So what in the world could an ancient, boring book like this and legislation like this have to do with me? Well, actually, it has everything to do with me, and it has everything to do with you. Because whether or not you realized it, dear people, we are all sitting in front of a mirror today. Because as we are reading these texts, remember what we said earlier? When God saved Israel, he brought them into a special covenant relationship with himself, and he said, "You are special people who know me as nobody else knows me." And you know what? When we come to the New Testament, we find that God, when he saves a person, he brings them into that very same special relationship with himself, and he says, "You are very special to me." And you know what? We don't have time, but in the New Testament, these very terms that we saw back in Exodus 19 and elsewhere, those very terms are used of New Testament believers today. A special people, a peculiar people, a holy people, a set apart people. All those same words are used of people who are members of God's family today, who are, as we would say, part of the church today. So how do I know that this is very applicable for us? I know it because all throughout the New Testament, God says, "Whatever I wrote before is written for your instruction and your help." But I know it, number two, because of what I just said. When I read the New Testament, I find God is saying these very same things for 21st century Christians right here in the United States of America. So let's very quickly, as we conclude, let's just walk back through these 4 points and just ask ourselves some really honest questions. Number one, if holiness forbids pagan practices, when was the last time that I did something that I really stopped and asked myself a question, something like this? Is this something that pagans do? If I do this or if I engage in this activity, will I look like a typical unsaved American? That's what we ought to be asking ourselves before we engage in certain things, because that's what the children of Israel had to ask themselves. Question number two, if holiness requires me to submit to God's lordship, am I always arguing with God and saying, you know, well, why do I have to do this and why can't I do that? And who does God think he is that he would even tell me to do this? That's illegitimate. We don't have a right to do that because God said, when I speak, it's a message from heaven. And you simply need to realize if you're really saved, I'm Lord of your life. I call the shots in your life. Number three, holiness requires me to be holy because God is holy. Do I not want to live a holy life because I'm afraid of being separate or distinct from everybody around me? And I'm ashamed of the fact that I walk to the beat of a different drummer than they do. Isn't that oftentimes why we don't want to be different? And remember, God isn't calling his people to be weird, strange, corny. No, he's simply saying distinct. That it will be evident to people that you march to the beat of a different drummer. And isn't that often what we don't want people to know? And that's why we just go ahead and engage in pagan practices. And finally, question number four, holiness requires me to obey all of God's instructions. Do I think I have a right to Sunday-only Christianity because Monday to Saturday are my days? God says absolutely not. Do I think I'm self-sufficient and autonomous, that God has no right to tell me what to do in the nitty-gritties of my daily life, even when I'm in private? God does have the right to tell me. That's what he was telling the children of Israel, and that's what he's telling New Testament believers as you read these New Testament epistles.
You've been listening to the Chapel Hour, coming to you from the campus of Bob Jones University. Our speaker was Dr. Royce Short, Dean of the School of Religion at BJU. For a cassette or compact disc copy of today's message, send a check for $6 to Campus Store, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, 29614. Be sure to mention the name of the speaker and today's date. The Chapel Hour has been sponsored by Bob Jones University.